my armpits sweat a lot. And so this is just a way to, when I go like this, advance, it's just to cool me off, okay? So let's see how this works. All right, microphones here. All right, God and morality. There we go. Here's my family. I am deeply blessed to have three girls. I'm the groundskeeper in a sorority house. That's pretty much all I'm good for. I keep things well maintained. I fix any leaky faucets or whatever. Fix toys. Crazy glue is great for fixing toys. From left to right, that's our middle one, Madeline, my beautiful wife Deb, our youngest Kaylin, and our oldest Emma. And on Labor Day, we went to go apple picking up at Anderson Orchard in Mooresville. Fun place, I recommend it. You know, we're just trying to make memories, you know, do fun things like that. And so we take them up there, and it just got done raining, and it was all wet and everything. And we're thinking, this is like at least a few hours of making memories here. And after about 20 minutes, the girls were ready to go home. But they were snacking on apples. They enjoyed it. We had fun. And we're still eating the apples. So that's my family. So where are we going tonight? Three points. Where are moral values found? And then we'll take a look at the connection between God and morality, and then finally application. And here's what's going on. Ideas are very important, and they shape and influence how we move and exist as Christians on this campus. And so that's why there's this semester, this thematic semester, and so far every student I've asked has no idea that's going on. Which is, I just think, ironic because it's supposed to be this big deal, and yet each year it gets more hidden and outside of the general community, at least my experience. And so this one is called Molecules to Morality, and it's looking at what are the evolutionary roots for morality. As I lined up to speak tonight, I just thought, you know, you guys need to know some of this stuff. Because, I'll get into why. Just so you know, this stuff it may feel like up here, but my goal is to let you feel it down here as well. Because there are consequences to the ideas that we believe in. And if we can't make that connection, if we always stay up here, we miss our full humanity if we don't make that connection to the heart. And I want you to know, this is going to probably feel a little heady for some of you. Some of you will be yawning and sleeping. I want you to know that's okay. All right, you can fall asleep. I don't want you to, but there's grace. Even I fall asleep on myself. But I don't want you to miss the point that morality, this idea of morality and its connection to God is deeply important. And it's one of the foundational things for we as the Christian community who proclaim the gospel and are called to proclaim the gospel. That if there's no connection between morality and God's existence, then why worry about being good? Okay, why worry about these things lead to good behavior and lead to life? These things that the Bible says we ought to do. Why do them if God does not exist? Okay, so I want to make that connection and also be unified in that, not just with the head, but with the heart as well. So for those who are followers of Jesus Christ, I've kind of already explained the importance. For those who do not consider yourselves as followers of Jesus Christ, here's what I want to present to you. I seek to offer you a plausible position for the realm of morality that exists. It infiltrates all of our language. We think of bad jokes. You know, well, what makes a bad joke? What makes a good joke? What makes good behavior a bad behavior? So I want to offer up a plausible explanation, a plausible position for this connection of morality. That I think is one of the foundational points for the gospel. Because it ought to hit at the heart. Okay, this is not just about, again, ideas. It's ideas that matter. Because, next slide, sorry. bummer. Okay. What I'm looking at is this picture of starving kids. You've seen them on commercials. Is there something inherently wrong about kids starving at other portions of the world, in our own country? Is that something really inherently wrong? Or is that just mere subjective feeling that we have when we see certain things? Okay, and so these ideas and these positions have real effects. Because if it's not something out there in the world, a state of affairs that I need to respond to, such as children starving, and I've got money that I can give to them to help give them food, then that requires something of me if it's out there in the world. If it's not, then there's no standard. All I need to do is just change my feelings. And then I can move on with my life. But if there's something objective out there that requires something of me, then I need to take action. Okay, so the stuff about morality is very crucial. So what do I mean by moral values? I'm just talking about rightness, wrongness, good or bad, something you ought to do, virtue, vice. The Christian theological term is sin, as something that's vice or evil. Blameworthiness. These are what I mean by moral values. And we reference moral values all the time. It is bad to falsify results. I'll go ahead and I'm just going to tell you to click because it's not reaching. It is bad to falsify results in science. Okay, that's a moral value in science. Next one. One ought to help another if they are in a position to do so. Failure to do so leaves one blameworthy. If you see somebody who's fallen and can't get up, like Retreat Man, you know, if he had just ignored those circumstances, he would be blameworthy for not acting in accord for helping somebody when he could have done that. And thankfully, he did. Eating healthy is good. Eating unhealthy is bad. Okay, so we use this language. We see these things and refer to them all the time. So how do we understand them? All right, go to the next one. All right, don't worry about the chart. I'm going to take you through this. Okay, it looks, there's going to be six different positions. Okay, two first categories, non-cognitivist and cognitivist. Okay, cognitive, once you think mind, cognition, knowing. Okay, so the non-cognitivist position says that morality has nothing to do with truth or falsity. Okay? The two positions are emotivism and imperativalism, imperatives, commands. And I'll get through it. So with those two categories, there's further two more. Go ahead and go to the next slide. Moral values are either found in us or they're found in the world. And so I'm going to start off with dealing with those in the circle that say that moral values are found in us. Okay. Emotivism. Translate moral statements such as murder is wrong to, ugh, I hate murder. That's really what they translate. When we say that murder is wrong, all we're saying is expressing an emotion. So we're not saying anything true or false about the world. We're just expressing our emotions. Next. So the one for command, imperativalism. That's a great word to impress your friends, okay? It translates moral statements. Okay, so when we say murder is wrong, what I mean by translate is they take that information that's in there and change it. This is what it actually means, okay, that act of translation. It translates moral statements into commands. So murder is wrong is translated into the command, don't do murder. Okay. Now, I want you to notice that it changes the meaning. When I say murder is wrong, as opposed to don't do murder, when I say don't do murder, I'm not expressing something true or false. I'm just telling you to do something. Okay, it's disconnected to whether or not that action is right or wrong. And so this translation doesn't fully cross over. All right, next. So those first two positions don't really capture what we mean. When we say murder is wrong, or that one ought to help somebody if they have fallen and can't get up, we don't understand them to just be expressing emotion. We think that they're referring to something much deeper than just emotions, and much deeper than just a command. Okay, so there's something missing in the translation process. And so that's why I think, just right there, I'm going to set those aside. I think those are good enough reasons to set those positions aside. I don't think they're adequate. And so I'm going to move on to now the cognitivist position, the category, which says that moral statements such as murder is wrong, is true, can be true or false. And from the chart, you see that there were two positions within that, the subjectivist, so the subject, moral values, true or false, are found in the individual, in the subject, or the objectivist, found out in the world. Okay, so again, we're still in this category of moral values are found in us. All right, one more. Thanks. So private subjectivism. You've probably heard the statement before. That is true for me, but maybe false for you. So murder is wrong. Well, that's true for me. Okay, murder is wrong. But it may not be true for everybody. Okay, that's just my private subjective position on that particular moral. Okay, so that's what private subjectivism is. It's private. Therefore, it comes from me. Doesn't come from anybody else. We can differ in our morality, and that's okay. There's nothing. There's no objective. Something above individuals that say one is right, one is wrong. No, it's up to the individual that determines that. So murder is wrong is a psychological fact, like I dislike murder. That's how it's translated. So again, look at that. When I say murder is wrong and I disliked murder, again, I'm just stating me. I'm not saying I've lost some of the meaning of murder is wrong. I'm just stating a psychological fact about myself that I'm uncomfortable with the thought of somebody killing somebody else. But I'm not saying that that action is inherently, that there's something in it that makes it wrong. I'm just saying I don't like it and I'm uncomfortable with it. So that's private subjectivism. The next one is cultural relativism. Murder is wrong states a sociological fact. Okay, so it's no longer just a personal subjective, it's more in the culture that we as a community, we have said we are uncomfortable with murder, and therefore we have set up rules against it to prevent it or to put up some sort of punitive actions if somebody commits it. But again, it's translated into we in our culture dislike murder. All right. So because, again, the translation is lost from murder is wrong and from other moral statements that we take for granted as we live, move, and breathe, that I'm going to dismiss. I think I've given a basic reason. Okay, actually, can you back up one more slide? I forgot one point, one important point. The fact that it doesn't translate, it changes the nature of the statement. It's gone from murder is wrong as a moral statement to I dislike murder or we as a culture dislike murder. Those are non-moral statements. Those are descriptive statements. Okay, I'm just describing. We as a culture don't like murder. That merely describes. That doesn't have any moral value in it. Okay, so that's where the translation is lost. It's gone from being a moral statement to a non-moral statement. Okay, thank you. Please advance. Thank you. All right. So I've knocked out four, and now I'm down to two. Ethical naturalism, ethical non-naturalism. So let's take, and these are, we've now shifted from theories that are in us, moral values are in us, to moral values are in the world. Okay, and there's two basic positions within that. Ethical naturalism. So ethical terms such as right, wrong, good, bad, etc., can be defined by or reduced to natural scientific properties that are biological, psychological, sociological, or physical in nature. So they would translate, ethical naturalism would say X is right, and they would answer it by, well, what is apparently approved by most people, or what most people desire, or what maximizes desire or interest, or what furthers human survival. Okay, now this is going to be the big one for this molecules to morality. They're looking, since if it's true that we're from evolutionary origins, then morality is simply an adaptive feature. Really quick, did I read that time right? Did that say five? Okay. All right, let's move on. Okay. All right, move forward to the Michael Ruse quote. Two more. Thank you. So here's Michael Ruse, atheistic philosopher, does a lot of study between evolutionary theory and Christian ethics. This comes from his article on that. He says, the position of the modern evolutionist is that humans have an awareness of morality because such an awareness is of biological worth. Morality is a biological adaptation. Okay, that's going to be a key word for this position. No less than are the hands and feet and teeth. So all these things right here, these are biological adaptations. Morality is simply another adaptation. It's an aid to survival. Okay, move forward. So here is his argument in summary form. If naturalistic evolution is true, then all features of humanity are adaptive. Naturalistic evolution is true, thus all features of humanity are adaptive. Morality is a feature of humanity, thus morality is adaptive. Okay, I'm just summarizing his argument to make sure that I've read his quote correctly. Forward. So since morality is adaptive, it is illusory. That's his conclusion. That is, moral value statements do not refer to real properties in the world. Okay, the problem here, and this is unfortunate for a philosopher, and I do not consider myself a philosopher. I have a master's in it, but I do not, I'm like beginning. Only because if I had a PhD, I might call myself a philosopher, but I don't. But here, unfortunately, he has his PhD, and he's committing something called the genetic fallacy. And that is, you confuse how a belief comes, comes to have a belief with the rationality, the truthfulness of that belief. So in other words, if let's say that I am born and I never leave the house, I am stuck let's say I have really bad parents and they keep me in the closet all growing up. You know, keep me well fed and everything, let me use the bathroom, all that stuff. But, and they tell me that, they kind of force it into me that the sky is blue. Okay, so I have this belief the sky is blue. Now, does how I came to have that belief have any bearing on the truthfulness of that belief? No, it doesn't. If I do, I've committed the genetic fallacy. I've confused how I came to have the belief with the truthfulness or the rationality of the belief. Now, Michael Ruse's argument says that in virtue, because of our morality came about as an adaptive feature, therefore, morality is illusory. Okay, now he has confused how we came to have the belief with the rationality of the belief, of that morality is something out there in the world. Okay, so he's committed the genetic fallacy. And anybody who takes this position, who says, well, it's just simply evolved characteristics, and thus we can dismiss morality. If they have done that, then you can say, look, how one comes to have a belief has no bearing on the truthfulness or the rationality of the belief. All right. So that's the genetic fallacy. That's key to understanding this. All right, so go ahead and keep moving forward. All right, so at best, if that's how we did come actually to have morality is through evolutionary processes, at best, all this line of reasoning shows us that our subjective perception of objective moral values has evolved. That's all it says. It doesn't say anything about whether or not objective moral values do exist in the world. It has not denied that. It does not imply that objective moral values do not exist. Next slide. So here's my summary. And I know I went quickly through that. Any argument that concludes that moral values are mistaken to be in the world in some objective way that is not reducible to psychology, etc., because our awareness is an adaptive result, they've committed the genetic fallacy. All right. So based on that reason, I reject ethical naturalism, and I go to ethical non-naturalism. Okay, one more. Okay, remember, I want to get us back to the heart now. Morality deals with people. Deals with the people around you, deals with people all over the world. Okay, advance. I want you to take a good hard look at this picture from World War II. There's a Nazi soldier shooting a mother and child. Now, I want you to feel the weight of that situation. As a parent, it has a little bit more weight to me than it would have if I was still single. All right, next slide, please. Here's what Motivism says about this. And I'm gonna argue that this is a clear case that objective moral values are in the world. That this situation right here, including the intent, what this soldier is planning and intending to do, we take all that in this picture, and I'm saying that is objectively morally wrong. Okay? I'm saying that's in the world. I'm not just expressing my emotion like emotivism does. I'm not just expressing dislike. Next. I'm not just saying that the soldier failed to follow this command, don't do this. Private subjectivism, it says nothing bad about, there's nothing bad about this. You're simply experiencing your personal psychological state as you look at this picture. And then finally, cultural relativism, again, it looks at this picture and says there's nothing inherently wrong about this. The group of people with whom you live amongst us as Americans, we just don't like this. We're uncomfortable with this. With this soldier about to murder this mother and child, we're just uncomfortable with it. There's nothing inherently wrong in that picture. And then finally, ethical naturalism agrees that this is bad, but puts it in quotes. Only because evolved traits in our biology point us to that. And the herd mentality tells us this is not beneficial for survival. There's nothing inherently wrong about that. It's just bad because it's not good for survival. It's not good for keeping our genes moving forward in our species. It's the firings in our brains. It's completely physical in nature. Our discomfort, us seeing this picture as bad. It's the firings in our brains that tells us this is bad. Okay, and so I point to this as an example of objective moral values, a moral fact. And so now we get the ethical non-naturalism. The moral facts and properties are irreducible. We cannot reduce them to biology, to the firings in our brain. We cannot reduce them to sociological factors that we as a herd have agreed not to murder because we're simply uncomfortable with it and other things. It's irreducible and part of the furniture, so to speak, of the universe. Okay, let's move forward to the second point when you see God and morality. So just keep going forward, please. All right, thanks. Here's the connection for God and morality. This is called the axiological. Okay, here's another cool word to share with your friends. Dude, man, you're like so axiological. Yeah, even I can't say my own jokes. So, and it goes like this. If God did not exist, objective moral values and duties would not exist. Objective moral values and duties exist, therefore God exists. I won't go into the fun logic of that to show you that this is a valid argument. I'll just deal with the premises. Okay, the first one, this is very intuitive. People all across the board, atheistic, theistic, if God does not exist, yes, objective moral values that would affect us all would not exist. Keep going, one more. How could there be anything objectively binding on anyone or any culture if there's no supreme being that has made us all? And also, if God does not exist, then there seems to be no objective basis for moral qualities being in the universe, meaning no goodness and no evil. Okay? All right, next. All right, so the second premise denies that condition and says objective morals. It denies that objective moral values do not exist, which is the equivalent to saying objective moral values do exist. And thus, we deny that God does not exist and conclude God does exist. Now, and I've given you evidence for premise two by citing the picture of the German shoulder that as an actual moral fact in the world, that and I have shown that other positions about where moral values come from leaves us still thirsty and unsatisfying. Okay, it fails to really get at that situation. And so we can reject those other positions as a result. Okay, let's see, one more, please. This position is also the best explanation of genuine feelings of guilt and shame. I want you to think about this. We don't feel guilt and shame towards objects. Like, if I were to hit this microphone and knock it over, I would not feel sorry for it. Okay, I, I would have no emotion at all. But you put Jake up here, and I knock him over, and I would feel sorry for him. Well, maybe. But my point is that we feel guilt and shame towards persons, not objects. And so the fact that you feel guilt or shame whether when you've realized or thought that you've done something wrong, it points to, what that points to is that there is a moral law that you have violated, and there is somebody, a giver of the moral law, behind it. Okay? We feel guilt and shame not towards objects, but towards persons. And so I point to the guilt and shame that each of us, I'm sure, have. I put my money, I put my retirement money on it, that which is not a whole lot, but it kind of needs to be more. Colin, maybe you can help me out with that. I'd put my life, not my life, not that, my money, that each of us has felt guilt and shame. Each of us have come to an awareness that we have done something wrong. And what I do is I point to that, I appeal to that, that your experience of that, and that points to a moral law giver. Because we do not feel guilt and shame towards objects, we feel it towards people. And there is a moral law giver to which we feel that guilt and shame towards. All right. All right, so application. One more. All right. So here's the question I put before you as application, and that is what to take away from here. What do you do with your badness? What do you do with it? Go forward one, please. Moral qualities are not a figment of our imaginations. You are discerning something true about the world and yourself. Next. If you have ever felt shame, that means you have discerned something bad about yourself. If there is a God to whom we are morally accountable, then how do you deal with this badness that you feel? How do you deal with it? I mean, really, does amassing... well, let me just keep going with what I have. Next. Christianity agrees that we are all guilty before this moral law giver, this creator. Okay, so Christianity agrees with this position. This is the Christian position. Objective moral values are in the world. They're not just expressions of personal feelings or cultural feelings. They are in the world. Next. We cannot alleviate our guilt by trying to amass good deeds to compensate for our badness. I mean, really, how does just trying to do something good in order to cover something bad really deal with the bad? Other than just make you feel good for a little bit longer until you're reminded that you did something bad. I mean, does really doing something good deal with a past action? If that's the case, then why do we put murderers in jail? Especially if after murdering somebody, let's say one instance, they murdered somebody, and then let's go with 50 years of doing nothing but good deeds, helping the poor and everything. Does that take away the badness that he did? No. We would say that's ridiculous. He would still be charged for that bad crime that he committed. So just amassing good deeds does not deal with the badness. Okay, so we're still stuck with this crap that's in us, this badness that we experience in ourselves. So the Christian story is that God has dealt with this. He's alleviated our guilt by sending someone, namely Jesus, to substitute our place for dealing with the guilt that we have before God. So there's a penalty. There is a punishment equivalent for the crime, the badness that we have. So God has allowed someone to step in our place to alleviate that guilt, to remove it from us. And next. Through Jesus, you can be freed from guilt and shame before God and experience unadulterated goodness in relationship with God. So that's my claim. That is the Christian gospel, that moral qualities do exist. We have badness. We have junk in us. We cannot do enough good things to alleviate, to take it away. God has done something about it in his goodness and his love, which is a good quality. And he has made a way out for us to alleviate the guilt and the shame. Okay. So, and all this is dependent on this argument that God exists and moral qualities lead us to God's existence. Tonight, after this, I'm going to have a Q&A time. I'm just going to share another argument that seeks to establish God's existence. If you have any questions about what I've shared tonight, or anything that I present. It's just going to be a 10, 15-minute presentation, and I'm going to open it up for Q&A. Any question is open, okay? This is a time for you, for your questions. We as crew, we want to be a resource to you. And the same thing, we are unashamedly believers of the gospel, and we think that it's true, and we assert it as true, and we are willing to handle, and inserting that it's true, we also think that we could be wrong. Okay, anything that you say is true also has the possibility of being false. And so we're open to questions and dialoguing with people who have good questions and want to come up with some who have deep questions in their hearts, and we want to meet them there. Okay, so this time is for you if you have those questions and want to deal with that. If you're not able to make it, there's my email address, matt.bays@indiana.edu. Please contact me. I'd be happy to. Let me close this in prayer.